This is DJ Kick, and you're listening to Steve Kelly Delivers, where you get a glass and a half of inspiring, influential, and interesting guests with every podcast. You can follow Steve Kelly Delivers on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Steve Kelly Delivers is listener-supported on Venmo.com.
Hello, and welcome to episode 26 of Steve Kelly Delivers. It is a podcast that brings you quality entertainment first class. Check out my website, stevekellydelivers.com. From there, you can find my Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram accounts. Now, Steve Kelly Delivers is a listener-supported podcast, so if you like the content of what you are hearing and you'd like to lend your support, I'm going to tell you a couple of ways how you can do just that. First, you want to find my show on iTunes, subscribe to it, rate it, write a review, and tell your friends about me. Next, you can be a patron on Patreon. I acknowledge my patrons in the intro of every show. And lastly, if you would like more of a personal touch, find me on Venmo. And if you make a donation via Venmo, I will personally thank you during the introductory portion of the next podcast. Now, let me deliver my awesome conversation to you as I introduce my next guest, Samuel Ronan. Samuel Ronan, thank you so much for making an appearance on Steve Kelly Delivers. I cannot wait to get this conversation going, man. How you doing?
Oh, likewise, Steven. You know, had a good day today so far. I'm looking to add to it with this here interview. This is my first one in a while, so if I'm a little rusty, you know, don't hold it against me, all right?
All right. I'll try not to, man. So, Samuel, for those who don't know you, let me just give a quick little part of history of what you've done. Yeah, see, I'm a little bit rusty, too, because it's been about a month since my last podcast, so. But hey, here we go. In 2017, you were running for the DNC chair position. Now, like, how did you prepare yourself to get in the running for that? Like, what did you have to do?
You know what? This is actually one of my favorite stories. So I left active duty to run for office, right? And as naive as I was back then and thinking it should be an easy gimmick to get into politics, it really wasn't. And part of that was, you know, running for a different position than I had originally intended and having to move out of my hometown from Ohio to a different place, which is where I happened to work. And I ended up running as a Democrat, of course, because my values aligned, right?
Yeah.
Well, towards, of course, the 2016 election happened, and we all know what happened there. And then there was a crisis of leadership. So the interesting thing was they were doing these future forums long before I started, and there was one in Columbus. And I had actually contacted my the Democratic chair of my county, asking her how to get involved in that, how to see it, where to go, what were all the requirements, and she gave me the info, and I finally managed to go to the Columbus Forum. Well, I was also on reserves duty at that time, so I went from the reserves, got off work, hurried home, changed into regular clothes, and just booked it to Columbus, and it had already started.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was actually supposed to have been a speaker. So when I arrived there, you know, it's already in full swing. There's an empty chair, so on and so forth. And I was like, you know what? I could be that guy who just crashes the show and say, hey, this is my spot too. But, you know, I was like, whatever. I'll just sit back and listen. Maybe there's no reason for me to get involved, right? So I listened to them talking, and it was Roy, the guy... Shucks, I forget the names of everybody, but Keith was there too. And they were talking, and I was listening, and there was one question that was asked out of all of it, and this is the one that gets to the answer of your question there. The question was, what would you do as chairman to get Democratic support? And Roy gave his answer, then you know, the next guys gave their answer, and it was just basically an elevator speech for all four people that were on that stage. And I was like, you have to picture this, all right? Just visualize in your mind this stage. It was barely a raised platform, a few chairs, and a video, microphone in hand, and the audience was literally 5 feet away, 10 feet away, something like that. All they had to do was get up out of their chair, microphone in hand, step up to an audience member, hand them the microphone, and say, what do you want me to do? What would it take for me to earn your trust and respect to come back to the party? Not a single one of them did that, and that's when I knew I couldn't support any of these people, that I'd have to put my hat in the ring and actually show them what leadership was. And that was literally it. I would have actually thrown my support behind whoever, but there wasn't a leader on that stage.
There definitely wasn't. And I'll tell you what, when I was watching that chair debate, what little radio video time they gave you on the show, what little time you're allowed to speak, you were the one that made the most sense. You were the most charismatic. I mean, you would think that you've been speaking for years. I mean, I just thought you were giving out the right message.
Well, I appreciate that. And that was kind of, you know, it's kind of funny because I was, what, 27 at the time? So here's this cocksure 27-year-old basically just out of active duty saying, what the hell is going on here? We need actual leadership. We need to do these things. And like you said, I only got to answer, I think, two questions
on
the forum, but it was like, you guys, you're not talking about what's needed. You weren't there on the ground. You don't see what these brand new candidates are dealing with. There's no infrastructure. There's no support from the top down. It's all the money, all the support is at the federal or at the state level, and it's like, you can't run an organization like that and expect to win. And that, to this very day, that's what's happening. So, you know, unfortunately, they didn't learn their lesson, and it doesn't seem like it's going to happen.
No, and we're going to get into that too. But also, you brought up something that I can't let the conversation go any further without thanking you for your military service in the U.S. Air Force.
No, I appreciate that.
So, what was your job in the Air Force?
So, while I was active duty, I was what was called a PMAL. And to make it a simpler thing, my job was metrology, the study of weights and measures. I would make sure test equipment was fully operational and putting or measuring the right amount of, frequency, pressure, torque, whatever the case may be. I was basically a grunt, fixing equipment that was used on aircraft. So I always like to say I was, flying airplanes vicariously through others.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a very important job, man, because without those measurements being right, those planes would not have taken off too well.
You know, it's funny. Everybody says without their job, you know, airplanes couldn't go, but you know, it's kind of interesting when you look at it. We were the baseline, right? So it's everything maintenance-wise, medical-wise, starts with us. It started with us, whether we were, you know, calibrating scales for fitness tests or for, you know, medical personnel, or we were calibrating torque wrenches that were being used to fix, multi-million dollar aircraft. It began with the PMAL. And, so to a degree, you're not wrong. And it was pretty cool. It really was and remains a rewarding career field. Oh, and I guess to answer your other question, in the reserves, I was personnel. I was on the admin side. So I was in charge of, like, over 3,000 reservists' personnel records, their entire duty history, their training, their awards and decorations, everything. And
oh, wow.
That proved that they were actually in the military. I made sure was, you know, ship shape and ready to go.
Nice.
So, yeah, pretty fun stuff. I mean, it might be boring to some people. Oh, you did desk work a lot, but you know what? I got to do a lot. I got to be in the Honor Guard. I got to work with the unit deployment office. I got to send boys and girls down range and make sure they have everything they needed. So I kind of had my hands in a lot in a very short amount of time, actually.
Nice. It does sound pretty rewarding, fulfilling, and you know what? You enjoyed it. Hey, that makes it all the more better, man.
Absolutely.
And then shifting gears back to politics. Now, a year before, you, in 2017, when you ran for the Democratic chair position, a A year before that, you were actually a candidate in the 1st Congressional District of Ohio?
Yes, very briefly. I put my name in the hat for that. But then I went and did a state representative run because it was going to be a primary position. And they already kind of had their preferred candidate. And there was an empty spot for the state rep. So I was like, that's fine. I'm not here to be the end-all be-all. I want to serve my community, and I feel the best way at the time was to do it through politics, you know, and not to in any way belittle my service or anybody else who's currently in. It's just, it's a different mission, literally. You are either, you're following through with what the suits in Washington are saying. So what I wanted to do was have a voice in Washington to make sure that when we send our boys and girls across the sea, that we're doing it for the right reasons. And so that's what I saw was not happening, that the leadership in Washington was absolutely not doing that. And even at the state level, they're not. I mean, look at most state governments. They could give a damn less about, you know, people like you and me. And it shows. So I figured one way or the other, I was going to get the job done. And next time around, I could shoot for the federal position, which is actually what I did in 2018. I ran for Congress again.
Nice. And, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, the suits and stuff shirts in D.C., they're the ones calling the shots, deploying troops overseas to war, and they really don't know what's going on. They don't listen to the people at the lower level. They don't listen to the reports, okay, look, this is what we need to win the war in Iraq or Afghanistan. They just don't listen, and as a result, we just tend to occupy these countries for a very long time. And it just doesn't work in our favor.
No, it's not. And, you know, it's really frustrating, too, because I'll be the first to admit I enlisted, and my first thought was to fight the enemy, defend my country. And, you know, once I went into basic training, one of the first things I did is went to... So you get 1 day to do your religious whatever you want to do, you know, Christian. They even had Wiccan there. I went to the Muslim faith service, and I wanted to learn about, quote-unquote, the enemy, because at the time, right, you have to remember, this is 2010, this is the height of the war, I was basically, like everybody else, brainwashed into thinking that, you know, these Muslim terrorists, these Muslim enemies, these Muslim extremists, right?
Yeah.
And I went there, I learned about the culture and the religion, and I'm like, this doesn't jive. This doesn't match up at all. This is not a religion of violent extremists. This is a very peaceful, if not academic, religion. The Islamic faith is really about knowledge and community. And so once I learned that, it completely changed my entire mindset. And I was like, all right, I mean, I'm still here to serve, so I'm gonna, you know, do my part. But I realized that the enemy is truly extremists. They are like, they are actually bad people, and they are misusing a religion to justify their own ends, just like Christians did for, I don't know, what, years?
I know. I was just going to say that same thing. And, of course, they still do. And it is, like, the extremists just represent a small sect, a very small sect, and they interpret the religion as they want. They hijack it and create terrorist groups, and then that just spirals and, you know... This right. Really,
and you know, as the years went on and the thing continued, what really bothered me was like, yeah, our foreign policy is jacked up. But then, not only that, what really solidified, you know, my desire, because I figured if I could at least work my way up the ranks, you know, maybe commission, become an officer, you know, be in charge of some things, it would give me some leverage. But really and truly, with the government shutdown in 2013, it just completely lifted the veil from my eyes. I was like, no, if I want to make a difference, if I actually want to serve my country, then the only way to do that is go into politics and be the voice of those who cannot be heard. And this is the other part, not to get, you know, cliche or anything, but that government shutdown was 2 weeks. 2 weeks of engagement, 2 weeks of our men and women dying, bleeding, suffering, while their government was in disarray, not giving a damn about them. And I thought, the worst thing I mean, to put into words, those people died not knowing if their country would ever come out of that. I mean, think about it.
Your
government shut down. You're still fighting. You don't come back. You don't know that the government came back for a few more years. You don't know what happened after that. You just know that while you were sitting in the infirmary, bleeding out, watching your friends die, that your government was in disarray, and that your sacrifice may very well have been for nothing. And that's just, that was it. That was why I was like, I can't do this. I have to find a different way to avenge, or at least make sure that their lives weren't spent in vain. And I still feel that way to this day. It's just, you know, well, now I have a little bit more experience as to how difficult or tricky it is to navigate those waters.
And that really puts it into perspective of those soldiers that were, like you, in your own words, bleeding out and dying, not knowing that this would all end in another couple of weeks, and that's unfortunately their last memory.
Exactly. So, for me, it was very, very personal. I mean, sure, I'm not going to claim that I was like Tulsi Gabbard, who was, you know, in the middle of the surge, you know, combat medic. I can't make those claims. But that doesn't mean that I didn't value, you know, the lives of my service members, or, you know, wouldn't have picked up a rifle and fought by their side if given the opportunity. I cry more than what a lot of those suits can say for themselves. I mean, the military service in Congress combined is less than 10%. Less than 10% of those people ever served, and they're the ones beating the drums the loudest. It's just appalling to me.
Absolutely. And I know you just mentioned Tulsi Gabbard. Tulsi, I support you. I'm sure that you do as well. I think she would make a very great president.
She's in the running.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, oh yeah, no. And she's a very strong symbol, too, of what a good, charismatic female leader should be. Like, honestly, she has, you know, some policy issues that I don't agree with. And, you know, everybody's on the Bernie train, and nobody knows who Tulsi is, so her chances aren't great. But here's the thing. She is putting herself in a position to be heard and to make a name for herself, which is no different than what I did for the chair. Does she want to win? Yes. Did I want to win? Absolutely. But if the consolation prize is shifting the narrative, which is what I accomplished and what I am assuming she will eventually accomplish, I mean, that is still a humongous victory.
It is. It's a victory in itself.
That's right.
Now, how hard was it for you? Because like you, I mean, I'm actually not registered as a Democrat. I'm a no party affiliation, but I align with the political left, democratic socialism, those ideals. How hard was it for you to switch party affiliation and run in the Republican primary in 2018?
So technically, for the state of Ohio, it's pretty easy. You just go up to the DMV, or you vote in that primary. That's as easy as it is in Ohio. So that's actually how easy it was for me. And because I was the candidate, it was a de facto party change. So I didn't have to wait for the primary. I didn't have to do anything else. I just literally had to register or file my paperwork as a Republican and get Republican signatures. So that wasn't difficult at all. What was difficult was getting any sort of opportunity to speak. Obviously, Steve Chabot, who was the incumbent, he had no interest, desire, or reason to debate me. And of course, it was in his best interest not to, because even among conservatives, the democratic social policies do resonate. And considering I have a military background, it's not like, and I don't mean this in any like dismissive way, I'm a strong proponent of the military. I'm a strong proponent of being overseas if it's for the right reasons. I have different views on the Second Amendment that don't necessarily align with leftist policies. So, you know, on that side of things, I could have appealed to conservative voters in the language that they are familiar with. Every time I talked about universal healthcare education, I talked about it from the standpoint of a blue-collar worker, of an enlisted airman, who did work for a living, who did get their hands dirty, who does know what it takes to get a skill and to have a skill and to have a living based off of that skill. And that, you know, our economy, the American dream, was founded on skilled labor, you know, and with, like, say, gun control, you know, people, even among conservatives, the regular voter, they're okay with gun control. What they don't like is the registration. They don't like those words because it sounds like a breach of their rights. And I was able to talk to them. I was like, listen, you want a gun? I want a gun. But I went through the training to wield the gun. I had the right, you know, understanding and the knowledge and the respect for the gun. That's all I'm saying. For gun control, we just need to have that same knowledge, that same respect instilled in a legislative sense so that when somebody does carry, concealed or otherwise, you know that that person's going to be responsible with their weapon, which isn't the case, as we unfortunately see with the rise of these mass shootings, the hate crimes that are sparking all over the place. And even, I'll say it, our law enforcement acts like it's the Wild West. They're murdering minority groups left, right, and center and getting away with murder. And to me, the reforms would be to prevent that or to hold people accountable. If you fire your weapon and you take someone's life and it wasn't because yours was an imminent danger or you didn't exhaust other options, I'm sorry, but that's murder, especially if you're a cop, especially if your job is required to carry and possess a firearm. You know what I'm saying? Like,
oh yeah,
better, and there should be more restraint involved. So when I talk to people like that, as a Republican to fellow Republicans, they understood this. Like, you know what? That makes a whole lot of sense. You don't want to take my guns away. You don't even want to make it more expensive for me to have the gun. You just want me to go through a day or two of training, be at least have the check mark stating that I understand the laws and use of force. I'm like, yeah, that's it. It's still quote unquote a registry, but instead of it, you know, being this malicious government, you know, list, you know, people hate being on lists apparently.
Yeah.
What is to prove that you have the training that if you do use your firearm incorrectly or unsafely, or God forbid one of your children gets a hold of it, you're held accountable. All my gun control was accountability, and that resonated. So even a leftist ideal of gun control can appeal to a broad swath of the country with the right words, with the right context, I should say.
It definitely can, and especially with you being on both sides of the political spectrum. I mean, when you put common sense in mm-hmm. key issues, bipartisanship really should be so much easier to achieve.
It should. And unfortunately, right, what you have is a clash of extreme ideals. You have the far right and the far left, quote unquote, but we don't have a left that's actually in office. The left is us.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, and I'll just touch on this briefly because it may come up later on, is we, as in leftists, the progressive community specifically, are just as extreme in their zeal and ideals as the conservatives or all the alt-right belief systems. It's, there isn't room for that conversation, even if the core discussion is reform. It's just we can't speak each other's language because we're so focused on what we think is the correct way, we don't realize we're actually talking about the same thing. We all want gun control. It's just we disagree on the extreme versions of that. But ideally, the solution, like you said, is a common sense middle ground, not centrism, because that's bullshit. I mean, but like the centrism is just nonsense nowadays. It's like both sides to every story. It's like, no, I'm sorry. If one side is Nazis and the other side is not Nazis, then the only right side is the not-Nazi side. There is no two sides to that argument. One wants genocide and euthanasia for anything that isn't white. But I'm sorry, that's wrong. There is no debate. You're wrong, and you're a criminal, and you should be thrown in prison for it. That's not free speech. You are threatening the lives of everyone who isn't lily white with that kind of rhetoric. And people don't understand that. And it's hard to breach those kinds of conversations because of, again, the massive divide in the political spectrum and people on either camp.
Oh, and there definitely is a massive divide in the political spectrum of this country. And a lot of that had to do with the person who is in the White House right now. He tends to get on Twitter. He tweets. He agitates people. What are your thoughts on President Trump? What do you think of him?
For one, I will never refer to him with those two words back to back. And secondly, it's terrifying because people want to disagree left, right, and center and argue that Trump does not mirror the rise of Hitler and saying, well, he didn't do X, Y, and Z. I'm like, listen, the only difference between Hitler and Trump at this point is the fact that we don't necessarily know for sure if there are actual concentration death camps. And I can say and, you know, talk about, you know, some of my friends in the major cities who have seen their peers disappear from work, from school, from whatever, and never be heard from again. So you tell me if we don't have a Gestapo. You tell me if we don't have hidden detention centers. I mean, we know about it now. We know that kids are being 4,000 kids or something. I don't know. It was maybe less than that. But still, thousands of children separated from their families, thrown into adoption centers and child services programs. You have kids being literally kept in cages. You have the tent cities. I mean, if those aren't concentration camps, you are literally blind and ignorant. I'm sorry, I can't say it any other way. If it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and acts like a duck, it's a duck. And that's what those are. Those are concentration camps. What we don't know is if there's a euthanasia program. And I could speculate, and I could say, you know, I've heard the rumors from people who have had connections and gotten out of there alive. But, of course, I can't, you know, I don't have any physical hard proof. What I do know is things are darker in America than we are being led to believe. I know that for a fact. And I also know that if this continues as it is, the stain, the ability to come back from that is going to be incredibly difficult and will require a leader who is not afraid to hold those persons accountable and responsible. You have a representative, and I might not be saying her name correctly, Ilhan Omar, the Muslim woman.
Yeah, recently elected to Congress, yeah.
Yeah. So she's been, you know, she's been calling them all out, AIPAC, even Obama, right? So nobody felt unsafe under the Obama administration, right? But what did he do? I mean, he did escalate a lot of our presence in the Middle East. He absolutely bombed the bejesus out of the Middle East. And, you know, he bailed out banks. A lot of the economic gains that we had, sure, sort of helped the middle class, but it really allowed this oligarchy to take place. The difference between Obama and Trump, unfortunately, is Trump is unabashed about his disdain for the poor people and is being very vocal about it. And once again, quite successful at creating that that divide, pitting people against each other. And again, it's because as a billionaire, he's painted himself as a rebel. And so what do people want? They want a populist. They want a rebel. They want someone to go against the system. And the only one in power going against the system, quote-unquote, is Trump. Unfortunately, it's in the worst ways possible. He's going against the system on paper, but behind the scenes, he's bringing us to our knees. He's absolutely destabilizing the American government, making us, he pulled us out of the Human Rights Council, for God's sakes, and now police forces become more violent and brutal. We have concentration camps on American soil. I mean, honestly, yeah. The only thing left to happen at this point is to find out how insidious it has really become. And we might not see that for, unfortunately, years to come. Or hopefully, if Trump is toppled from power and someone courageous and powerful enough takes his position. I don't know if Bernie is that person. I don't know if Tulsi is that person. But I sure as hell know that Kamala Harris isn't. I know Joe Biden isn't.
Yeah.
And the darlings of the Democratic Party right now.
Exactly. The establishment politicians are just going to keep the status quo going. And you know, like the like darker things that are going on in this country that you brought up, it's, you know, we always think that it's this kind of stuff only goes on in other countries, that no, that doesn't happen here. But there are things that happen here that would probably boggle the mind of a lot of Americans.
And it's unfortunate, too, because now it is coming in the news, but people are dismissing it as fake news because he has successfully created this image that the media is the enemy, which is the same exact crap that Hitler, Stalin, and Mussolini did. So when people say that Trump isn't America's Hitler, I'm like, you are willfully ignorant, and I'm sorry, but that goes back to the extremist ideals. You can't say that to those people. You have to show them. And then when they see the articles, which are extremely watered down versions of the truth, they're like, see, it's not that bad. Hitler did X, Y, and Z. It's like, but we have concentration camps. We have kids in cages. We lost them. There are missing persons all over the place. And the refugee crisis at our border, we are treating them as an invading army. When did we turn into this? And people are like, well, security, well, this, well, that. And it's like, unfortunately, here's the way it goes, right? Unfortunately, the die has been cast. We are going to have to ride this out as a country. And it's going to be a very difficult, probably 10 or 20 years before we really get this settled, unless we can get a bunch of Tulsi Gabbards, AOCs, you know, Ian Omars in office to really rip this Band-Aid off and then put these legitimate war criminals in prison. That's what it's going to take.
Yeah, and I mean, the way that people idolize Trump, it's... And like you were saying earlier, the words president and Trump and following each other in the same sentence is a very scary thing.
It is. And, you know, okay, fine, the Democrats are trying to do impeachment proceedings. Okay, that doesn't solve the problem. That just takes care of the freaking side effect, the symptom. Because Pence is no different. He's no better. In fact, he's probably a lot worse simply because he's more eloquent and well-versed in political discourse. You have Trump, who's, I mean, I don't know if he's just putting everybody on with his lack of intelligence or if he really is that bad, but he doesn't come off as a grimy politician, whereas Pence absolutely would.
Oh, yeah.
Things that are now that are being tweeted every Tuesday would be happening behind the scenes, and we would be left blind and ignorant.
And, you know, I honestly think, I really cannot believe that Trump is this as stupid as he makes himself out to be. Maybe it's a ploy, like how George W. Bush, when he was in office, he made himself look like a country bumpkin and an oaf. You know, I'm thinking that's probably strategy, maybe so that he can do his dirty work behind the scenes and people won't suspect it. But I mean,
That's the only explanation. Otherwise, we actually have a child in office who is also a tyrant, which is just as bad as if he's a mastermind doing horrible, horrific, evil things in putting on airs. Either way, the equation balances out to we are doing horrific things. We are violating human rights left, right, and center, and that cannot go on.
No. And definitely with... You know, Trump tries to perceive himself as a strong leader. I mean, you see how he embraces these other dictators like Kim Jong-un. I mean, when I was watching the exchange when he was talking to him in Vietnam, I mean, almost like what I got out of it was Kim Jong-un was like smiling like he was trying to hold back the laughter. It's like he didn't want to just come right out and laugh in his face at how incompetent he was and how weak he was. I don't know if you saw that, but that's what I saw when he was conversing with Kim Jong-un at that summit, what we saw on TV anyway.
Yeah, and that's the thing too, like, a personality like Trump needs to be the center of attention. So that's personally why I never mention anything, why I don't, you know, debate about him. I don't share anything that involves him, because if we can silence him and ignore him, he loses his power. That is exactly how weak he is. But of course, he says some horrific, just off-the-wall stuff, and it makes the news because this is a world leader saying it. If Vladimir Putin did or said half the crap Trump did, we'd be at war with them.
Yeah.
You know, and if Kim Jong-un had, and I don't mean to say that North Korea isn't a threat, but if their military power was more threatening to the United States or the Eurasian continent, we would have gone to war with them too. The thing is, they're not doing it, and the superpower of the world right now, America, their quote-unquote leader, Trump, is saying these things. Who's going to go to war with America? Unfortunately, again, and it goes back to, you know, either the narcissism or, you know, the insanity, it's kind of like Nero of Rome. He let the entire city of Rome burn while playing the frickin' fiddle.
Yeah.
That's what we have.
Oh, and I remember that in history class. I've always hated Nero. Just the mention of that guy's name, like, oh, it's such a prick. If I was alive back then, I'd just try to go out of my way to punch him right in the face. It's just a very hateful leader.
And that's what we have now. So, you know, call it Hitler, call it, you know, Trump, call it Nero. That individual, that mentality, that mindset, that kind of leadership has finally arrived on American soil. And that, to me, is one of my greatest motivators for why I ran in 2018 and why, despite my current circumstances, I have an intention to run at least one more time, just to go to one of these major cities, New York, Los Angeles, Boston, whatever, and just speak. And maybe that time it'll finally click. Because here in Ohio, again, the conservatism is strong, and the mindset is, I don't want to say brainwashed, but I do want to say that the general population of these rural states or these predominantly conservative states want someone who is, if not actively fighting for them, at least saying they are, which is, again, why Bernie Sanders is actually popular in Ohio and throughout the country. Because he says the same, you know, quote-unquote rebellious stuff that Trump is, except it isn't horrendous and doesn't make you want to take a shower afterwards.
Right. What he's speaking out against is, healthcare is a universal right. Every American should have it. Every American needs a living wage. I mean, he's speaking as an outsider on issues that really matter. Things that will actually help people. And you're right, like you're saying about Trump, that his rhetoric is just more or less to get attention, and he's addressing issues that aren't really relevant to the American people's welfare.
Right.
And in 2017, you called out the Democrats for rigging elections, which, of course, they did by putting the wrong candidate up against Trump. If the Dems hadn't cheated Bernie in 2016, do you think that we would have President Sanders right now as opposed to President Trump?
I think, my answer might actually rub a few people the wrong way. I think, yes, we would have had a Bernie Sanders presidency. I do think that. I also think we wouldn't have, of course, done some of the heinous things that we've done. However, I don't think it would have been a very effective presidency, because he would have been met with the same kind of stonewalling that Obama was met with in his last 2 years, except doubly so. The Mitch McConnells and the Paul Ryans of the world would have literally just prevented Bernie Sanders from doing anything other than using executive orders. And I don't think he would have had a strong enough Congress to support him or a strong enough Senate to support him. So Bernie Sanders, the president, yes, would have been a great leader, but I think the Bernie Sanders presidency would have been met with a whole lot of red tape and corruption.
Yeah, and opposition, absolutely. Unfortunately, I would tend to agree with that. I just think that that's exactly what would have happened. They would never have let an outsider have that much of an influence on really bringing about change. But I mean, what we actually need right now is like that kind of charismatic leader, like an FDR. I mean, that is the president we need in 2020, definitely.
Well, and see, and that's what I'm saying, like, Bernie Sanders can't do it alone. He simply can't. And what I said earlier, we need a Congress full of, you know, Ocasio's and Omar's and, you know, Tammy Duckworth's. We need a Congress full of Tulsi Gabbard's and senators. You know, unfortunately, there aren't too many that we can count on, because even, say, Senator Gillibrand, right? She does have a very strong left policy, but the things that she's neo-lib on are not good. She's very corporatist, and I don't think she's a war hawk. I could be wrong about that. I like I said, I've been kind of keeping a pulse on current events, but not digging deep into every candidate out there. But like in the Senate, we don't have very many allies. We don't. It's Senator Sanders, Elizabeth Warren when it suits her, and that, you know, maybe Gillibrand and Sherrod Brown. So we have four people that we can tentatively rely on. Four out of 100. So we would have to stack, you know, the Senate and the Congress to augment and support a Sanders presidency or even a Gabbard presidency. Otherwise, they would just be met with opposition, which is what we saw during the Obama administration.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of some of the presidential candidates running, are you a fan of Andrew Yang?
I actually have no idea who that is.
Oh, all right. Well, Andrew Yang he's a philanthropist, a billionaire. He's looking to run, but one of the key things of his platform, and this is something that eventually the United States and the world is just going to have to come to grips with, and we're going to have to do, we're going to have to implement it. He wants to implement what's called the Universal Basic Income, UBI, about $1,000 a month, I think, that he wants to give to everyone over the age of 18.
That was actually one of my policy positions when I ran for Congress.
Wow. So you were for UBI too?
I am, and for different reasons. Not just because it would make sense, but because... So the problem with UBI is you couldn't do it federally unless you have a different source of income, which would most likely be the result of legalizing marijuana at the federal level, and especially reallowing hemp to be America's cash crop again like it was prior to prohibition the UBI wouldn't be sustainable with federal
federal funding.
Yeah, so the it's $187 billion, maybe it's a little bit more now, maybe it's a little less. $187 billion divided by 1,000 wouldn't be enough to go to every 18-year-old in America, which is about 270 million of us. What that would actually, the welfare programs, that would actually have to be a state-funded process, and it would still be a net savings of like $500 billion per annum. Because right now, the way it works, not everybody has access to it, for one, and for two, it's just convoluted. It has all of this red tape, all of this administration, blah blah blah. So UBI would affect a greater swath of people, and it would save money, but it would be funded primarily through the state budgets, or if federal tax incomes could be fed through legalization of hemp and marijuana sales.
And you know what? I think that marijuana, it's making its way around its state levels. I think we are just getting closer and closer to where it will be just nationally legalized. I mean, every state, like even down here in Florida, a couple of years ago, we had passed the referendum to have medicinal marijuana on the ballot, which has now become legal. And there's so many states that have medicinal, recreational. I think in time we will get there.
I agree. And from my opinion, the sooner the better, not just because, you know, then you have a lot of people not being arrested for dumb things like possession of marijuana, but more so because of hemp. And I've crunched the numbers, and I don't want to bore you or your audience with, you know, the math and the figures, but suffice to say, the windfall that could be from tax revenue of hemp, specifically hemp, is in the trillions of dollars if it was at an industrial scale across the country, which of course is what would be able to cover the costs of UBI or literally any other project. I mean, could you imagine if $1.5 trillion was dedicated to healthcare, another $1.5 dedicated to education, and then you just give NASA what's left over? Like, our country would change overnight. So,
oh, absolutely.
When people say, how are you going to pay for it? Marijuana. I mean, honestly, like, that's the answer.
Yeah, that would literally generate trillions. And like I said, I think we are just getting closer and closer to getting there.
That's right. So, that's pretty neat. I'll have to look into, you said Andrew Lang?
Andrew Yang.
Yang. Okay. Yeah. I'll have to check him out.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how much momentum he'll gain, but he's in the running. And I mean, we still have like another 600 and something days before the actual election would take place anyway. So everyone that's in it now, there are so many names that they'll eventually get weeded out and thinned out, and we'll get a smaller and smaller group.
It's funny because Mayor Pete is also his name in the hat, and that's kind of neat. He got his name started by running for the chairmanship too, and I think, you know, he'll probably get a couple minutes of airtime. And I think what he's doing, I think he's actually going to vie for the governorship. I think that's what his real goal is. And he's using the presidency as a springboard, like the presidential campaign as a springboard to that. So it'll be interesting. We need leaders like that. We need leaders. You know, not everybody can be president. Not everybody can be senator or congressman. What we do need, however, is that kind of mentality at every level, from, you know, dog catcher all the way up to president. So if Mayor Pete wants to run for president and he gets it, great. If not, I think he's going to shoot for the governorship, and I hope he gets it.
Yeah. Like you said, we've got to just put people in positions of power in all levels of Congress that can actually get this country in the direction that we need it to go.
And not to toot my own horn, but I was kind of the first one to say that in the chairmanship debates. And as soon as I said it, the Pandora's box was open, so to speak, and everybody on that stage had to start piggybacking on it. It was kind of funny.
Hey, at least you got a phrase out there that people will parrot, and you know what? It's a good phrase, good message. And
so now
I was just going to say, speaking of keeping your message going, I know you said you do plan to run in the future for another political position. Have the losses in the past had any impact, or are you just able to like brush yourself off and keep the course?
Well, I'll say this. The first loss in 2016, that didn't affect me one way or the other. I kind of figured I was going to lose anyway. The DNC chair thing, I also knew I wasn't going to win. And I wasn't sure if I was going to stay as a candidate or just try and build the Our Voice nonprofit, which I did. We developed software. I'm no longer affiliated with it because I am a politician, so 501c3 you can't associate with actual politicians. But since I left, I was able to establish a good core of leadership, and they are doing great things. The app, the Hello Voter app, is it was designed to directly replace Nation Builder and the NPG van that the Democrats use, and it's growing. It's growing in both usability, friendliness, and awareness. And if we can continue creating these kind of products and getting people aware of them, it's going to revolutionize politics in this country. And to get back to your question, the only thing that I found difficult after my 2018 run was, and again, this might rub a few of your listeners the wrong way, it's the toxicity of our movement. The progressive movement is unfortunately now coalescing back under Bernie Sanders, but without him, we started tearing into each other. It was everybody trying to get to the top and destroying anyone who got in their way. And that, to me, was the most difficult thing, to see such promise and such opportunity, such potential, fall to the wayside for glory, personal glory. And my goal, if I run again, is to avoid avoid that toxic environment as long and as much as possible, and just stick to my guns. If I had just stuck to my guns and spoke and, you know, ran my campaign, things may have very well been a little different, or I probably would have still lost in Ohio. But I think a lot of the fallout that would have occurred wouldn't have if I had just left it alone. And unfortunately, I would say that's what stuck with me the most, and another reason why I've kind of been keeping my head down with politics, because I don't have the time, patience, or energy to get into those, well, there's no polite way to say it, but pissing contests with everyone.
Yeah.
It's like we're all on the same team. We should all be supporting each other and elevating each other, not trying to be the hero.
That is an excellent explanation. I love that, man. And totally on point, totally true. We do need to be supporting each other. Don't be the hero. Just be part of the team. Because you know what? As a team, that's how we win.
Exactly. And here's the thing. If a hero could solve our problems, by all means, let's find one. And let's elevate them. But there isn't one. Even Bernie Sanders isn't a hero. He is a great leader. He is someone who is motivating and inspiring. But he himself cannot do it alone. And that's what his message is. It's not me, us. And that, I mean, it happened in Chicago. They were chanting his name. He's like, no, it's not about me. And unfortunately, it's that cult mentality. And I don't mean cult as in a bad way. It's we as a country, Americans, we love the underdog. We love the underdog hero. We idealize a person, a concept espoused by one individual. You know, some person will save us, but what we've lost is our ingenuity, our community, the fact that the American dream existed because we had strong communities, we had strong families, we had strong ties to each other. And over the course of, you know, decades, we've lost that. And to the point now where we idolize or elevate individuals as the end-all be-all to solve our issues, and that's just not the case. Obama was supposed to be a hero, and he couldn't do it. He just couldn't. Sure, he also made some poor decisions. He also made some great decisions, but at great cost and without the support of Congress.
Yeah.
So that does. Now you have Trump. Sure, he has the support of his Congress doing his atrocious things, but that's why they're succeeding. If the Democrats did to Trump what the Republicans did to Obama, none of the nonsense that he's pulled would work. But again, that goes back to having weak leaders in the Democratic Party.
Yes. That, and you know what, Samuel? In closing, wrapping things up here, tell all the listeners where they can find you on social media, like what outlets you are on.
Yeah, so I still maintain my Facebook page, www.facebook.com/, I believe I left it at Ronin for Congress. And then I have my Twitter handle at Ronin the number 4 Progress. And I have a YouTube channel. You should still be able to find it. Samuel Ronin. It's not as big or bad as I would like it to be, but yeah, you can find me there. My website, however, is down, and apparently somebody bought my domain out from under my nose. So
wow, really?
Yeah, you can't find me on my website, but I can absolutely start doing that again, and I'll follow up with you on that. Unfortunately, like I said, you can follow me on those social media pages, but I wasn't going to start ramping up again until the middle or the latter half of this year. But I appreciate it. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to do a shameless self-selling.
Hey, no, that's great, man. Hey, I look forward to it. I can't wait to see you back in the game running again. And, you know, once again, I just wanted to thank you so much for making an appearance on my show. I, you know, like when I seen you in that running in 2017, the Democratic chair, I knew we were tied together on Facebook. I'm like, you know what? I would love to talk to Samuel Ronan. I know he'd be politically, we're on like the same page with just about everything. And it was everything that I hoped it would be and better.
And outstanding. And likewise, Stephen, I appreciate it. You know what? You've given me the motivation, maybe not motivation, but, you know, the incentive to start ramping things up a little earlier. Maybe I made the wrong call. And you know what? I'm man enough to admit if I do something wrong. So, you know what, Stephen? Thank you. Thank you for giving me this chance.
Hey. You're welcome, man. And it was a pleasure. And on that note, it looks like it has been another successful delivery.